Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. How did I forget the date already? It's the 14th of September. Rick Sanchez is joining us this hour of the program. He does the Rick's List show on CNN in the afternoons, and he is the author of Conventional Idiocy, Why the New America is Sick of Old Politics. He is the first national news anchor to combine traditional network news with the power, he says, of social networking tools like Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook. And he hears from many Americans every single day. Rick has an interesting background. He joined CNN in September of 2004. He has reported from New York City, coverage of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. He's reported from war zones in Afghanistan and Nicaragua, the invasion of Grenada, and the fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier regime in Haiti. He contributed to the network's comprehensive coverage of Hurricane Katrina that won a George Foster Peabody Award. He was born in Havana, Cuba. He reports while interviewing newsmakers simultaneously in Spanish and in English. He has reported live from Cuba numerous times and has interviewed Fidel Castro. We'll talk to him about that. He was an anchor for a TV station in Miami, and he worked for 2 years as a correspondent and anchor for MSNBC and attended Minnesota State University Moorhead and received his undergraduate degree in journalism from the University of Minnesota in Twin Cities. We have listeners in that area, so you may want to particularly call in and talk to him about his days there. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We have much to discuss. We'll look at various figures, various programs, why the traditional media needs to listen more to people because they have a lot to say. Don't give us fluff news. Concentrate on issues that are very important. He includes all of that in his book. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address for you to use that. I feel like I ought to say our Twitter too, but I'm not up to that yet. Sorry, Rick. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we also do have a Facebook page if you want to put comments there, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Rick. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Hey, Rick. I'm in Wisconsin. How are you?
You are awake today, sir.
Yeah. I am excited about having this conversation because I know this sounds like, you know, I'm saying something just to make people feel good, but I swear there is no part of the country that I adore more, because as I describe this to people everywhere I go, the most genuine people in the country live in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas, et cetera, et cetera. I truly, truly believe that, and I know it from firsthand experience going to school there.
So what the heck are you doing in Atlanta?
You got to go where the jobs are, baby.
I'm with you. I grew up in this part of the country. I left for a while, and it feels like it's home. And yeah, you're right. It's great.
Well, listen, if they want to take the CNN headquarters and move it to Minneapolis, St. Paul, or put it somewhere between those beautiful churches around Madison or Milwaukee, then you know what? I'm game. I'm there. I'm taking Ricky and Savannah and Robbie and Remy and Gordo the dog and my wife Susanna. We're all moving up.
All right. Let's do it. How did you pick the University of Minnesota?
It picked me.
It did?
I went to school in Miami, of all places, being a Cuban exile and a Cuban refugee, as Tony Montana would say. And I got a football scholarship to go to Moorhead State, which is out here, around Fargo-Moorhead. And while I was at Fargo-Moorhead, some professors got together and they said, you know, you speak two languages fluently. You're doing really well in school. The University of Minnesota is going to offer three big scholarships this year to students like yourself through CBS News. And we'd like you to apply and we'll back you on it. You know, we got your back, as they say. So, you know, Kathleen, I applied, and lo and behold, they chose me to be one of the first fellowship students under the original CBS News scholarship.
Oh, wonderful.
And so I worked through WCCO and CBS, and it worked out great. I mean, I didn't think that a kid like me, being at that time, a Hispanic, would even be able to succeed in this business. Because whenever back then, because I'm old, so back then when I looked at people on television, they were all white men. There were no women. There were no blacks. There were no Hispanics. So I remember I talked to my mom and dad, and they said, that sounds like a great opportunity, son, but what are you going to do when you graduate? When we turn on the TV, we don't see anybody who looks like you do in the news. Well, to CCO and and CBS's credit, they were trying to make an effort at the time to bring more people like me into the fold, and I was one of the first ones, as they say.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. You know, I love to hear about people's parents, too, and I love what you write in the book about your dad. You worked with your dad. Your dad did hard labor, and how you would spend driving around in Miami looking at the restaurants in which he had worked. Tell us a little bit about your dad.
My dad is a immigrant who has a fourth grade education. His dad died when he was in fourth grade, and he was a peasant in Cuba. So as a result, he had to go to work in fourth grade. And when he tells stories, he's a self-taught man. He reads and writes and has taught me every single thing that I know in this world. Mm. He is my hero. He is, in my mind, the smartest man in the world and the smartest man I'll ever know. And it's interesting because he didn't have the formal education. And when you talk to a lot of folks who come from places like Cuba, because we're political exiles, you hear people say, oh, we were so wealthy and my father was a famous man and we left all this money because we were wealthy and rich and blah. Well, that's not the case with me. My dad was comes from very humble situation. So the one thing I learned from my dad was love and work. And I started working when I was just a little boy, and he drove a truck. I mean, he washed dishes in the hotels, and then his other job was driving a truck and delivering furniture. And he took me with him to work, and one day he took me to work, and we had to make this late, late delivery. It was a long drive from Miami to Boca Raton. Now, Boca Raton is where all the wealthy people live. That's where all the highfalutins are, you know?
Yeah.
And we went to this house with this beautiful portico chaise, and we'd finally gotten there, and I was so tired. We had to deliver the furniture. Back then, a lot of the furniture had like that formica, and you had to be careful because one little bump and boom, the whole thing would have a crack through it. So we got it into her house, and when we were done, I said to this fancy lady, as I thought of her, said, would you mind if I had a glass, if I can have a glass of water? I'm really thirsty. And she goes, no, but you can have water outside. And she pointed to the spigot where her pets are.
Oh.
And I remember thinking to myself, wow, that's kind of sad. So on the way back, I asked my dad, I said, Dad, why are people like that? Why did she treat us like that? She said, son, you have to understand that lady just did you a huge favor. She made you understand that you have to really work hard in this life to do something and to become somebody. And those words stuck with me. And the fact that my dad was able to even take a negative and turn it into a positive and all of his life's lessons were fabulous. So when I write in my book about immigration, I think a lot about that because I tell people,
yes,
you know, when you look across the street and there's some guy cutting your neighbor's lawn, and he's an immigrant from Honduras or Mexico or wherever he comes from, and there's a little boy next to him that's usually his son, and he's helping him collect the grass or the leaves and stuff, that's me. That, mm-hmm. That's who I am. I know I put on a fancy suit and get all cleaned up now and do the news on CNN, but that's who I was, and it says great things about our country.
And it stays with you. She probably also taught you something about generosity. I mean, as a young child, you must have said, I'm never going to be like this.
Exactly. I get real bothered when I see the lack of compassion, the xenophobia, the lack of understanding with people today. It does seem like we've created a bit of a partisan divide amongst us in America. It's, you know, it doesn't fit the philosophy of the Wisconsin and Minnesota nice, but in certain parts of the country, you know, it's almost like people whose skin color is a little different or whose look is a little different or whose religion is a little different. We've always been a little bit that way in this country if you look back historically, and I write about that in my book. But it is sad that we haven't gotten past it yet.
Right.
I hope we do.
And most people, you know, I love the fact that you really have plunged ahead Because most people who use Twitters and tweets and all of that, you tend to think of as being 21 years old or 22. You realized early on that there was something to this, that you're hearing from very intelligent people who use this media and can keep you informed and keep you on the scene of some fairly important events that are going on in the world. Can you talk about that, how you made the plunge into social media and how it makes perhaps the airwaves that you inhabit more democratic?
Well, I got to tell you, at first I agreed with you. I thought it was a crazy fatty.
Right.
You know, I'd come home and I see my kids, my teenage sons, they were on Facebook, et cetera, and, or MySpace, and they were talking to their friends. And I say, oh, good God, what is this?
Get a life.
Exactly. And I never really thought about it in those terms. I thought I was a little above this, you know. But then I started talking to some of the young producers on my staff, and they said, you know, if we really thought about this, there's this whole giant community with millions of people out there talking to each other. Why don't we go and talk to them while they're talking to each other and say, hey, check us out, because they're kind of drifting away from us anyway. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, that argument makes a lot of sense. And then I was in Chicago for a journalism conference where I was about to deliver an address. And the president of CNN at the time, John Klein, pulled me over and said, hey, let's have breakfast. I said, okay. And the first thing he mentioned to me at breakfast that morning was Twitter. He said, have you heard about Twitter? I said, I haven't heard about Twitter. He goes, let me describe it to you. And he went on to say it's a place where everybody connects and it's going to be the next Facebook, MySpace kind of thing. Well, he got my curiosity piqued enough, and I figured, well, if the president of the company is interested in looking into this, let me look into it. I went back, got together with all my smart young guys. I said, set me up with this social media and this Twitter thing. Let's try it. I put the laptop in front of me while I was delivering the news that night, and I looked at the audience and said, hey, guys, I got a Twitter page. Let me describe to you what this is. As I'm doing the news, if you've got a comment, a story, an idea, send it to me. And during commercials, I'll read it and see what you're saying. And if it's worthy, I'll check up on it. We'll vet it. Or I'll share your ideas, or I'll see if there's a consensus being built. Well, lo and behold, Kathleen, we started with like 100 people. Before you knew it, it was 1,000, then 10,000, then 100,000.
Goodness.
And it just kind of blew up. And it made me realize, you know what? For the first time, we've got a tool, technologically speaking, that we can use to communicate with people while they communicate with themselves and us. It's circular, and it's not just that old boring one-way communication anymore. And there's smart people. Sure, there's jackasses there too, but I mean, there's smart people. There's a lot of people who are very engaged, and I think this is good, as you said, for democracy. Democracy with a little D.
Right. And people have been able to really give you the inside of stories. You talk in the book about hurricanes where people have talked about what's going on with weather. It can be used, and you've used it in some fairly major news events.
Oh, no question. Stories have been broken now on Twitter. When the plane went down on the Hudson, the very first pictures and information came from somebody who was taking pictures and twit-picked them, and those were the first pictures that were seen on television. When the fires were out in, and I write about this in my book, how I got in touch with some people out there, and I said, they were tweeting me, and it was one of the volunteers, and he was caught in the middle of the fire, and he described it on television for us through twit pics, and then we contacted him on the phone, which is something we call going beyond 140 characters on Rick's List, my show on CNN. And just this week, when in fact, John Stewart had a good had fun with this week. John Stewart loves talking about me. I don't know why. He has a crush on me or something. But this week, Obama goes on TV and blasts John Boehner. Well, John Boehner turns around as soon as the speech is over and sends a tweet to me on the air to Rick Sanchez. Here's my response to President Obama, he said. So here we have the first reaction from the minority leader in the House to the President of the United States being delivered on our air through Twitter. And the interesting thing about that is, and this is what I tell people in my book, it doesn't matter whether you're a journalist or no matter what you do, it's important to be connected. These people are now reaching out to me because they know that I'm in touch with a bunch of other people. I mean, I'm no big shakes. People like John Boehner, John McCain, Sarah Palin, all these people who are now tweeting me, who would have laughed at this a year ago or two, are now using me as a vehicle to communicate with audiences because of all those people out there are communicating with me. So in essence, I guess what I'm saying is I've been empowered so to speak, by those people.
Right. You are connected, Rick. You are connected. Let's talk about Stewart for a moment, because I know you mentioned him in your book, and that you may have similar philosophies here, that you want to, both of you, keep people held accountable for their actions.
No question. And I've certainly had my share of confrontations with people who I've tried to hold accountable. And here's what I say in my book. There's two things that happen right now in journalism, and I have a chapter on each. One of them is the screamers, demagogues, the people who use microphones and cameras as a way of telling you what to think, using xenophobia, using scare tactics, and we know who those folks are, and I talk about it in my book. And to a certain extent, I'm critical of that type of thing on radio and television. And then there's the other one, you know. There's the journalist who doesn't do enough, push enough, say enough. You know, it's the guy who I call milquetoast. And by milquetoast, I mean he asks the questions that were written for him or her by a producer 2 hours before the show. Mm-hmm. They don't challenge their guests. They'll have people on who basically are saying it's raining, and then guest B will say, no, it's not raining. They give them two questions each, and then they walk away, when all the interviewer had to do was look out the window and see if it was raining and avoid doing the interview in the first place. But we see these things on television from time to time, and it's just crazy. And you're right, Stewart and I both call that type of thing out. But I think we need to go beyond that now. And I think I've gotten better as a journalist because I've connected, because people expect of me to push the representative. And people send me ideas and stories and research and information. I tell people sometimes, Kathleen, that I have 150,000 people out there just on Twitter alone who are my researchers, my assignment editors, my editors, my writers. I mean, I empower them as much as they empower me.
Let's talk a little, because I think that you're kind. You obviously know a lot of these big shots, people like Rush Limbaugh, et cetera, who you've met at parties, who you think are perfectly nice. But there is concern, as you know, in this country. I was driving to work this morning, and it's election day in Wisconsin, and there's a substantial Republican gubernatorial primary going on that's interesting. You know, I grew up, I'm older than you are, but I remember when we had fairness doctrines, and you couldn't, and particularly on an election day, you at least had the good manners to refrain from talking about a political race and to let people go and vote and think their own conscience and do this privately. And instead, you got people screaming at you, telling you who to vote for and who's best for you, et cetera. And a lot of people don't have time, and they listen to these people who are thinking for them and enjoying the power they have, and talking on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And it somehow is troublesome to me. I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about that, because you do in the book as well, that there are a lot of these people now, and I think that they are coarsening the discourse in this country.
They most certainly are, and it's sad to hear Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and some of these other folks. And I know it makes a lot of money for them. And I know that most of them now have private jets.
Right.
They have homes in the Hamptons. They have homes, you know, in many different places. And I just tend to think looking at yourself in the mirror is more important than having a bigger home and having a private jet. I just could never see myself doing or saying something that I know in my heart is not fair, and that I'm saying simply to play one demographic against another. Look, you could do it in your neighborhood tomorrow. Anybody listening right now to the sound of my voice could go into their neighborhood tomorrow, find the little old lady in the corner or the little old man, point a finger at them, make up a story about them, or exaggerate something they know and get everybody else rabble-roused to dislike them. It's the easiest thing in the world. And on a minor scale, that's exactly what happens on some of these shouting channels, as I call them, every day. I'm going to pick an audience, and my audience is whatever. People with freckles. And I'm going to make sure people with freckles know that the people over there without freckles are not as good as they are. And they're taking their jobs. And they're, I don't know, fill in the blank.
Right,
they listen to too much music. They wear their pants below their waist. It's just one thing after another. It's not nuanced. It's not carefully thought through. And it's not fair. And we got to get beyond that as Americans. But we're going through tough economic times. And as a result of that, I think sometimes people are easy to egg on right now.
Yeah. Rick Sanchez is our guest this hour. His book is Conventional Idiocy, Why the New America is Sick of Old Politics. We welcome phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We are on Facebook. I feel like I have to say this because he's our guest and he uses these mediums so successfully. And that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we also do have a Twitter account. I must say that I'm not proficient with this, but many of you are. And the name is at K Dunn Show. At K Dunn Show. Hey, how about that? All right, our phone calls are humming. We'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Rick, and let's start with Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Fine guest as usual.
Thank you, Frank.
And I would like to ask him, as someone who does have a podium, and as someone who's using their more modern interactive forms of communication rather than being able to speak to a passive audience, whether he truly believes that we're living in an age of idiocy, you know, and the experience that he has from his position, and idiocy not meaning stupid, but unsuited to a civic life. Because we live in a world where we've returned to that position where people no longer will refer to facts. Conviction and opinion is enough to be authoritative.
Oh, I love this guy, Frank.
I love Frank, too.
Frank,
no.
You're absolutely right. It's not the guy who screams the loudest who counts the most. That's not the way my mom and dad raised me. That's not the way our parents raised us. It's the person who has the patience to listen to both sides of an argument, think it through, use logic and his life experiences to then make the proper judgment. And unfortunately, you're right. Not enough of that happens. I say in my book that we are in the midst of a cure for this problem, because I believe, especially being a guy who grew up or came from a communist totalitarian system, that in the end, it's the power of people that will deliver us. And what I see going on right now in social media is people getting together and having to talk about these things. They dialogue, they don't duologue, and they make people like me and people like Stephanopoulos and people like the guys on NBC and all the other stations, they will make us better, because they will make us become engaged in the discussion as opposed to just liking to hear the sound of our own voice. And I called the book Conventional Idiocy because I think too often we were told that three or four pundits out there had all the answers. They had the conventional wisdom. And I kept hearing that, conventional wisdom. And I kept thinking, who the hell are those guys to tell me what the wisdom is? Two or three people who go on every television show and spout this stuff. You know what? More often than not, I was being told by people on Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and et cetera, that was idiocy. So that's why I called my book Conventional Idiocy.
Thank you, Frank. And you are loved by people who host talk shows, Frank. Come on over for lunch sometime. I've always wanted to say that to you. And let's talk about some of the idiocy that we see. You tell stories, and let me just pick this one because I think it's so outrageous. All these people who believe the president is born somewhere else, and you did something on CNN on this birther thing and had the birth certificate, et cetera. A couple questions. How did you take this issue on the air? And number two is why there are so many people, you know, who believe the president is a Muslim or that he wasn't born in America. I mean, there's so much idiocy out there that it astounds me.
Yeah, and it's idiocy that's only matched by vitriol, which is
right.
Tiresome, because you're absolutely right. When I saw that story I decided that it would be foolhardy for CNN to treat it as the way I described the story earlier, where you have one person saying it's raining
right.
and the other person saying, well, it's not raining, and all I have to do is look out the window and see that it's not raining. Well, it was a very similar story. You have people saying he was born in Kenya, and then you have people saying you were born in Hawaii, and all I had to do was look at the birth certificate to see where he was born. And beyond the birth certificate, there was actually an announcement in the Honolulu paper on the day that he was born, announcing to the world that this person had been born. The newspaper, by the way, is the Honolulu Advertiser, and we had a copy of that delivered to us as well. So when I went on the air that day, I had a copy of the Honolulu Advertiser. I had a copy of from factcheck.org of his birth certificate, or certificate of live birth, as they called it there at the time. I had the person who had actually validated it. I had an interview with the governor of Honolulu, the official from Honolulu who had validated the thing. I mean, it was just preponderance of evidence saying there's no question. This is a stupid argument. It really was an issue. It was just like looking out and seeing it's not raining and having someone tell you, no, it's raining. So I went on the air and I literally said to our viewers, every once in a while, a journalist needs to not debate an issue, but just declare an issue. And this is one of those that I need to declare. And I talk about that in my book because I think it's important, just like it's important for journalists not to be, as I say, demagogues, it's also important for journalists to have a backbone and believe in truth and deliver it when they see it that way.
Yeah, exactly. I want to know about Fidel Castro. I know you've interviewed him a couple times, and I'm just wondering, I've heard that he's a warm guy, that he's a pleasure to interview. Did you have a similar experience with him? Is he dictatorial? What's the guy like?
The first thing that I experience about Fidel Castro is how much he's protected, and especially, well, I was born in Cuba, so they made a huge exception in allowing me to even be in a room with this guy because they're very worried about assassination plots. So the very first thing, I haven't told this story very often, but since you've asked, the first thing they did is all these guys from Minister of Interior took me into a room. And they said, Mr. Sanchez, if you want to be in the company of El Comandante, the first thing you have to do is take off all your clothes.
Ooh.
And I thought they were kidding. And I was like, I have to do what? And they said, I'm sorry, but, you know, we were speaking in Spanish, obviously, but they said, tiene que desarrobar, tiene que quitar de la ropa, tenemos que chequearte en varios lugares. And they literally, you know, with a couple other guys, I went into this room, I disrobed, they checked every part of my body.
Goodness.
To make sure I didn't have anything on me that could possibly either blow up or where I was hiding a gun, or I mean, it was pretty incredible, actually. By the time I came out there and I sat down, and then I waited and waited, and finally, you know, and I'm surrounded by all these guys who are watching me, and I'm thinking, man, these guys are really trying to intimidate me, and it's working. finally, now you got to remember, I'm a kid, grew up in Miami. Had always been told by his parents, you know, that Fidel Castro had taken away our livelihood. So this wasn't just Fidel Castro. This was the embodiment of history. This was like a Franco figure or a Stalin figure walking in for me. And suddenly in comes this olive green garb giant, 6'5", with the beard and the uniform. And I was just, Kathleen, if you've ever imagined what it's like to be intimidated or stunned into just oblivion, that's what I felt like that day. It was like, oh my God, that's really him. It's like a kid really having the Jolly Green Giant walk into his bedroom in the middle of a dream. You know, it's like, so it was interesting. I found him to be the schmoozer, the charming intellectual that he is. He knew how to work the crowd. He knew how to work us. He knew it was me and two or three other journalists from around the world. There was a Japanese fella, a German fella, and a Spanish guy. And he was pretty awesome. He knew exactly what he needed to say, and he had us there at the time because he was picking a fight with Gorbachev over Glasnost. And it's interesting because then much later I had an interview with Gorby, And he and I had breakfast in New York, and I said, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, I said, let me ask you about Fidel Castro. You know, he was mad at you at the time, and he didn't even go see you off at the airport. And Gorbachev looks at me and starts screaming at me, and he says, let me tell you something, Sanchez. The problem with you Cubans is you make Castro too big. You make him bigger than he is. That's the problem. You have no way of understanding. He just went off. And I was like, ow. I mean, he lectured me on, you know, Silvio Russo-Castro relations, and it was really one of the most interesting experiences I've ever had. I backed off of that real quick.
Yes. All right, let's go to Pete from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call here. Yeah, I just recently learned about the owners of Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, and his second shareholder there, top shareholder, the Saudi prince, who's actually funding the mosque at Ground Zero, you know, and to find out that Fox News is creating this controversy, it just kind of ironic, maybe even a conspiracy theory, you know, that the Saudi prince, he's also starting another news network in the Middle East with Rupert Murdoch to compete against Al Jazeera, you know, and I'm just looking at these networks that are inflaming people's emotions with their hateful speech and And almost,
well, I'll tell you what, Pete, it's not really so much about conspiracy. We sometimes let ourselves get all caught up in that stuff. It really is all about just following the money. Rupert Murdoch is a brilliant businessman, and basically all he's doing is trying to make as much money as he possibly can. Fox News was recently involved in a lawsuit where they did something where they were challenged, and they had to go to court. And the defense that they used in court was, well, we shouldn't be held to the standards of journalistic enterprises because we really don't do journalism. We're about entertainment. That's actually what they held, that they're not journalists, they're entertainers. So given that as a proviso, then, you know, you can pretty much do anything you want. So they're very, very, very adept at creating a very watchable program. But oftentimes what they do is not necessarily news, and that's okay. As long as people out there like you are adept enough to pick up on it.
Follow the money. You've been told that by your listeners, by your viewers. What did you discover when you followed the money when it came to health care reform?
That 9 times out of 10, the people who were voting either for it or against it were voting for against it, depending on who had given them money. People who run our political system today are all about getting reelected. Being reelected gives them power, and the only way to get reelected is to collect enough money. And the people who give them the money know that, so they dangle the carrot in front of their nose and say, aha, here's the carrot, but here's what you have to do to get the carrot. You have to make sure you vote for or against whatever it is we want you to vote for or against. And when I looked at the healthcare issue, we did our research, and I talk about this in the book. What I found out is that the big three names who were in part of that committee that was set, bipartisan committee that was set up between Dems and Republicans to make sure they would come up with some kind of compromise for health care in the United States. They were also, coincidentally, with a wink and a nod, I say that as if really not coincidentally, They were also the three people who had gotten the most amount of money from the health care industry. And by the way, they weren't all Republicans. There was a Democrat and two Republicans.
Yeah. Oof, says a lot.
Does that surprise anybody?
No, no. Thanks, Pete, for the call. Marion in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I had a question or comment for your guest. Talk about pet peeves. My pet peeve is that everything is reduced to the almighty dollar. Everything.
Yeah.
And some of the things we value don't have a dollar amount. And just a real trivial one is every time I hear movies talked about on television, it's how much did it gross, not how many people saw it. It counts more what they paid to see it than how many people actually saw the movie.
You know what? You know what value is. I agree with you. I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Miriam.
You know, I am so dedicated to the things that I think matter in my life, and it bothers me when I hear people put other people down or describe other people that way as well. The things that matter in my life the most. First of all, my relationship with my wife, my four children, and my mother and my dad and my brothers. I mean, that means so much more to me than just about anything else. And when people stop me sometimes, like my producers will sometimes say, well, what are you thinking about? I said, you know, I'm thinking about Robbie because he got a zero last week in his in one of his exams, and I got an email from one of his teachers, and I'm worried, why did he get a zero? That means he didn't turn in his homework assignment. And maybe it was me. Maybe somehow I didn't talk to him enough that day, or I didn't say good morning, son, or maybe the night before when we were at dinner, we didn't pray enough. Or, you know, I start thinking about all this stuff, and it's like the things that in my life that I think are most important are the things that have to do with what lasts in life, and it's not money. It's about your relationship with your family, your wife, and the people you love. And you're right, Miriam. So often, I heard this the other day from Glenn Beck, and it really bothered me. He was criticizing, he criticizes me a lot, and he goes on his radio show, and he goes off of saying I'm whatever, conceited, stupid, dumb, bad guy, whatever. And then he was criticizing somebody else, and that person he was criticizing had also written a book. And he went on to say that the reason that guy was not good was because his book wasn't selling as well as Glenn Beck's book was selling. And then he went on to say, I'm in the New York Times bestseller list, and I've now sold a million copies. And you know how many people have bought his book? This many. And I was thinking, that's your criteria for value of a human being? And you're going to tell your viewers or your listeners or whatever it was at that time that you're better because you've sold more books? Is that really what matters? Because I don't think that's in any way Christ-like. If you're like, he goes on and he talks about being Christian and Christian values, and then that's what he uses? I was troubled by that. So I agree with you, Miriam, and I get your drift.
Thanks so much for the call. Here's an email that has come in from Larry in Oshkosh. How can you make the case that your use of Twitter and other social media sites democratizes the news when you have the power to cherry pick just the messages you want to use out of thousands, no doubt, submitted?
Well, same people who are sending me those Twitters and these emails, they are also listening to everybody else who's on there. See, here's the beauty of this, all right? And this is what maybe he didn't understand or doesn't understand about social media. The cool thing about social media is it's a community. Those people are talking amongst themselves. Then so they know what they are all saying. So when I go in there and if I was to say, I just went into a group of 10 people, and they told me the sky is green, those 10 people will then write emails and write tweets saying, Rick Sanchez is nuts. He just came into our group when we were saying the sky was red, and he said it was green. He must have not listened to me, et cetera, et cetera. So it obviously will all come back to you. See, the difference between one-way communication, which is the way we've always communicated in the past, which is radio, which is television, which is the internet at its inception, which is, I mean, going back to Gutenberg, the whole deal, is it, you get it, but you can't really manifest it. It's just you, but it doesn't engage you. That's why I call it the cyber porch. Before all these means of communication were around, our great-great-great-grandparents would sit on the front porches, and they would converse with their neighbors.
Yes, imagine that.
Well, that didn't happen for like 100 years with all the technology, and now it's happening again with social media. That's why I call it the cyber porch. They talk amongst themselves. They're engaged. The smart journalist, the smart politician, the smart businessman will then engage in those communities to know what those people are saying. Whether it's the guy who's buying your toothpaste, who, by the way, can't stand your toothpaste, and you better know about it, or they like it, but they just don't like the way you bottle it, et cetera, et cetera. That's why I think it really is the wave of the future.
Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
Let me bring up the dark side of social media.
All right, Ray.
Mm-hmm. When we used to sit on the porch, my family's from North and South Carolina, there was a lot of porch sitting going on down there.
It still is.
You never had the government looking over your shoulder at what you were saying. Now, every little thing you put on the internet or try to extract from the internet, every time you log on to the internet, the government is taking a tally, and you will, let's say you go to the PETA website a few too many times this year, maybe you won't be able to fly next year. So basically, you're not having a conversation with you and your audience. You're having a conversation with you, your audience, and the CIA.
You worry about that, Rick?
Well, yeah, to some extent, I agree that Ray is has some a concern that a lot of Americans have nowadays, that post 9/11 we started getting rid of some of the things that we had always cherished in this country. I've talked to police officers who've told me that they've been able to liberalize their standards for arrests now based on things that they never would have been able to do without a warrant in the past. So to a certain extent, Ray is correct. However, I don't believe it's at the extreme right now where we need to be concerned about conversations we have with ourselves or with our neighbors. I don't think it's going to be getting in the way of our ability to communicate. And if we ever get to the point where we stop communicating because we fear the government, then we're truly lost. So that wouldn't be a good alternative either.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Rick Sanchez is our guest this hour. His latest book is Conventional Idiocy, Why the New America is Sick of Old Politics. Here's our phone number. We have one line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Rick now, Jim in Pleasant Prairie is next. Hey, Jim.
Good morning. I'm afraid we've constructed a system where the biggest and loudest megaphone usually wins, and of course that goes back to who can put the most money into a campaign. But my main point is that we would have a much more intelligent body politic in this country if we were not the only Western country that does not have runoff elections. And the reason for that, you better go back to your amendment process within the Constitution of the United States of America. And if you had a shared monopoly, or as Ralph Nader describes it, as a duopoly, would you want to give it up? I don't think so.
I think you're right. I think to a certain extent that we could democratize our system more if we gave it a really good look and allowed other parties and other entities to flow into it. I'm troubled as well sometimes at the way the system is working right now. I'm not sure I have an alternative for it, but I think we probably would be wise to give it an examination. I do think, though, Jim, I'm convinced the biggest problem we have right now, though, is the money. I mean, the whole thing has just been set up so that the guy who collects the most cash wins the race. And, boy, I'll tell you, that's just troubling to me, especially not so much because of how they're chosen. What troubles me is what they do after they're chosen. I mean, you're going to tell me that these guys are not beholden to whoever it is that gave them, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. It belies logic. So I think that's the real problem with the system right now.
It is odd, isn't it? We were talking a little bit about this yesterday. Of course, TV ads are all over the place now in this state and in other states. And before the midterms, we ain't seen nothing yet. Wait till tomorrow. But it is weird, isn't it, that we have all these ads for people who are running to be public servants? It doesn't jive sometimes.
Yeah, I know. It's like the stories we've been doing on my afternoon shows out in Bell, California. I mean, a city where everybody averages $30,000 a year, and they're paying their city manager $500,000.
Yes, I saw that yesterday.
And he's got a retirement of $1.9 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
He's a public, like you just said, public servant. What is it about public servant you don't understand? You're there to serve. You should have another job and do this for free, and we'll make sure you get your expenses taken care of. But come on, you got four houses?
Right. Right. Four houses.
It just doesn't add up.
So were your viewers outraged by that story? I'm glad you kept it alive.
Oh, were they ever? I mean, yeah, I stuck my fangs into this thing and wouldn't let it go. I told my staff every morning, I don't care. I want to know who these people are. I want to know where they have breakfast. I want to know what they have for coffee. I want to know who's paying for this. And what we found out was, even if one's... This system, we learned, is called the... the charter system that allows them to pay their reps whatever it is they want to pay, because they've got a different kind of system than the other cities or municipalities in California. However, that being said, their retirement has to be paid by everybody else, including people even outside the United, outside of California. That's where it becomes problematic. So a couple of guys get together, they form a municipality. It's just a small number of people out there, let's say 30,000 people, 10,000 people. They decide they're going to give themselves these huge salaries. Well, those huge salaries then are recompensated when they get their pensions. And the pensions are drawn from the rest of us who pay our taxes. So, I mean, it's very, very unfair.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we're not going to leave that story alone, because I don't think it's right. And the people who do that should be held accountable.
Rich in Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen and Rick. It's really good to be talking to somebody who says he loves the Midwest almost as much as I do, because I maintain Wisconsin is the heart of America's heartland.
And you know what I've never done or experienced, and I feel guilty saying this, but I've promised my wife and kids that we will. And like every summer we say, this is what we're going to do, and we've never done it. I've never experienced the Dells.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I know. I, you know,
well, you've got to come to the Dells.
And it's like one of those places I dream about, and I see it, and I see the pictures, and I go on, and I work it on the internets and the Googles. I look at it, and I go, wow. And yet I've never been there, so I just thought I'd throw that out there. It's
okay.
One of those things. It's my Mecca.
Okay, well, you need to come and see it. It's a lot of fun. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay. Well, if you go to the Dells with your family, you're really going to experience the real America, which was founded, I mean, aside from the physical beauty, you're really going to see the everyday people with their workaday concerns and the hitherto neglected and despised masses of common laboring people who really do believe that they are America.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost. The reason the Midwest is different from the rest of the country is we haven't lost respect for those kinds of people. But on the national level, our journalists are not in control of the instruments they have to play. Mm-hmm. And our conglomerates have swallowed up newspapers, magazines, publishing houses, networks, and they've put profit over product. I could repeat example after example after Dan Rather and others.
You're absolutely right. I'm not going to sit here and disagree with you or try and take one of those priggish, overweening explanations of what it is that's happened. You are 100% right. There has been too much corporatization of the media and everything else in this country, and it's up to guys like me and gals like Kathleen to step up and say from time to time, no, you know what? We're a part of it. We got to draw a check. I got to pay my kids. I got kids going to college and all that eventually. And at the same time, you have to be earnest. You have to speak truth to power, and you have to do all the things that are important to not let some of those folks on Wall Street control everything. And that's why I say sometimes that some of the guys in the Northeast establishment, they're just as bad as some of the folks out there who I sometimes refer to as demagogues. I mean, sometimes they give a pass to things that they know are happening that they shouldn't give a pass to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but it's the truth.
Yeah. Well, Rich will be, he had to hang up, but I know I won't be speaking too much out of turn by saying that Rich would be happy, as would I, to take you down a water slide at the Dells.
Yeah, baby.
Hey,
yeah,
let's do it.
Take, my daughter Savannah and my son Remington, the little ones, and I got two big ones too. The boys.
Okay.
One's a senior and one's in college, but yeah, that's good.
Good,
that's
yeah.
Family fun.
Yeah, we'd have a good time. All right, here's a interesting email about what we see on television, and this caller wonders if maybe if you rely on Twitters, et cetera, you may get problems with certain kinds of shows. He writes, I give you the Balloon Boy as the obvious example. The old standards of verifying stories has gone out the window. Plus, we need much less talking and much more communication. The 24-hour news networks are filling up the airtime with more gibberish than you can shake a stick at. There are thousands of stories out there worth being told and never get mentioned.
Yeah, he's right. A lot of times those stories, you have to really investigate them. And investigating is a lot more expensive and a lot more time-consuming than to follow a balloon in the air. But at the same time, while I say that, let me also say that, you know, our patience and our attention span is not what it used to be in many ways. And, you know, as a journalist, you have to play both sides. You have to say, well, you know what, I'm going to give you a steak, but I'm going to make sure it has a little sizzle on it, because I know you like the sizzle. I'm going to give you your greens, but I also know that I'm going to tease you a little bit with dessert and give you that... you know, the pumpkin pie or whatever it is that you like. So I think those things are important as well. And it's hard to see a balloon in the air where police and fire officials and a mayor and every other dignified person is telling you on the air, yes, Rick, there's a little boy in that balloon, and I'm supposed to tell people, well, you know, we're not going to cover that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know what, if I say that, they're all going to run to Fox or MSNBC or wherever else they're going to run to watch the balloon. So, you know, you vet it, you do the best you can, but you also don't want to be a prude either. And right. you got to find the happy medium. You got to find the mix. And that's what I try to do. Mm-hmm. I don't give people car chases. I don't give people fires for the sake of fires. We just don't. We have a policy at this network. We do not do car chases. We don't do two-headed goats. We don't do circus stories. We do news. And we take it seriously. But we're also not foolish enough to know that if something is happening, that everybody's watching, that we're not going to put our cameras on it and try and report it as honestly as we can.
Rick, thank you. I really like you. Thank you so much. I've had a great hour. Come to the Dells.
I will, and I'll give you a call.
Please do. We'll show you good time. Rick Sanchez, Conventional Idiocy is the book, Why the New America is Sick of Old Politics. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks for your calls. Until tomorrow.